Now, as I mentioned, 3 John is a little different, in fact, a lot different than 1 and 2 John. It doesn't deal with heresy, it deals with a behavioral issue. And just to review, there's 4 main characters in 3 John. John, who's writing the letter, Gaius, to whom the letter is written, Demetrius, who is a traveling preacher of the gospel, and Diotrephes, who is apparently a leader in the church, to which Demetrius is traveling and probably Gaius attends this church. So those are the main players. And what we're going to do, it's a short letter, so we want to take it a section at a time will be the easiest way to do it. So let's begin with the salutation. Letter begins with a salutation. So we'll begin with verses 1 through 4. Okay? So, by the way, on your notes, we're on page 79. And we're at 3 John, and we're going to read verses 1 through 4, and then we'll go through the notes. If you have a question or anything you want to say, a comment, something you don't understand, raise your hand, and we'll take time for it. The elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. Beloved, I pray that in all respects you may prosper and be in good health, just as your soul prospers. For I was very glad when the brethren came and testified to your truth, that is, that you are walking in truth. I have no greater joy than this, to hear of my children walking in the truth. Okay. Now, let's go to the notes, and as we read through the notes, I'll be making some comments. But notice that phrase, walking in the truth. That's a very interesting phrase. There is a relationship between truth and how we live. There should be. There's a definite relationship there. Remember, truth is the foundation. And generally speaking, people behave based on what they believe to be true. And there is really only one truth as regards, you know, reality, God, so forth. And what John's saying here to Gaius is not only that you acknowledge the truth, but you're living it. Okay, 1. Since Gaius was one of the most common names of the time, it is not possible to identify the Gaius addressed in this letter with any other Gaius mentioned in the Brit Chadashah, the New Covenant. There's a number of passages I've given you there where the name Gaius is used, but we cannot determine if any of those are this Gaius. We have no basis of doing that. Gaius's identity, apart from what was mentioned in this letter, is unknown to us. So all we know about this man is what's going to be written in this letter. 2. Gaius may have been a member of the congregation Diotrephes appears to have headed. But whether he held an official position in the congregation is unknown. Now remember what we said. Just as a real quick review, Diotrephes was a leader in this congregation. Very authoritative. And remember the problem we discussed it last time in the intro? He forbid hospitality to traveling preachers. John knew of this. He wanted to deal with it because that's not the way we should be as believers. And apparently what's happening is this Demetrius is going to be coming to the area and will need hospitality. And John has already written a letter, apparently, again, to Diotrephes. And Diotrephes either just ripped it up or never shared it with anybody, but it didn't get through. And so now he's writing a letter to Gaius. And he's seeking Gaius's support in the matter, probably sending the letter with Demetrius. Okay, so that's the basic thrust of what's going on here. Okay, now number 3. You see in verse where it says, verse 1, whom I love in truth. Okay, now read 3 with me. The I whom I love in the truth is emphatic. implying that there were some who were hostile towards Gaius. In other words, first of all, that I in the Greek, they put it at the end of the sentence. That indicates it's emphatic. And what John is kind of saying there, whom I love in the truth, as kind of like implying, as opposed to those who do not love you. And so there's a possibility that this issue wasn't just a private problem between just the players here, but it was causing dissension in the congregation and possibly division. 4. Beloved, and that's to agape in the Greek, in verses 1 and 2, is related to the verb agapo, I love. A spirit of godly love prevailed in John's attitude towards Gaius. It is precisely the same spirit of love which was to dictate Gaius's attitude towards traveling preachers such as Demetrius. Godly love should also be expressed in believers' attitude toward one another today. So it seems as though John, at the very beginning of this letter, is modeling what he wants to be done in this congregation. He states right at the very beginning, this is how I love you. This is how we should love one another. He's modeling for him. Okay. A. Moreover, John's love for Gaius was in the truth. Very important. That is, it was genuine and in accord with God's truth. Remember 1 John, the importance of truth? Since love and truth are inseparable aspects of God's character, godly love will always be founded on God's truth. For example, God's love for the believer is founded on the truth of the gospel, the historical truth that Messiah died for our sins and was resurrected from the dead. So God's love for us is just not like some feeling we have or we see from Him. His love for us is founded on true historical events. It's founded on the truth. And the truth is the foundation of agape love. It defines it, and it enables us to practice it. And as a matter of fact, read B with me. Thus, believers should be on guard against those who appear to be loving people but deny the truths revealed in the Bible. There's many people like that, many cults like that. It must be remembered that Satan often disguises as an angel of light. And so we have to be careful because the cults can be very friendly groups of people, very attractive. And love apart from the truth is really not love. It's not godly love. For example, there was a time during the 60s when that generation, the 60s generation, thought that they had found the truth. And the Beatles wrote a song, All You Need Is Love, right? But it was divorced from the truth, wasn't it, that song? And so that generation really didn't find reality. As a matter of fact, one of the sayings of that generation, I don't know if you remember this, was God is love. Now, that's right out of the Bible. But they didn't take that phrase, God is love, and found it on the truth of the Scriptures. It had no biblical meaning to them whatsoever, and of course the result was really catastrophic for that generation. Because that generation, all you need is love, and let's throw flowers up in the air, that generation did itself great harm because of the fact that they were not in relationship with God. Okay, see, as in John's two earlier letters, the thought of this letter is dominated by concern for truth and love in the experience of believers. So John's motivation is still the same here. Truth and love. That's what motivated 1 John, 2 John, and this John, 3 John, but just the emphasis in 3 John is it's a different perspective. And you notice truth is in verses 1 and in verse 3 twice, and verse 4, 8, and 12, and love is in verses 1 and 6. So the foundation of this letter is truth and love. And this letter is going to address a problem, but the solution to the problem is truth and love. That's how the problem's to ultimately be resolved. So, continuing, next page. Okay, now this is very important, what we're going to discuss next, because it does involve a heresy. John, notice what he says here. Beloved, I pray that in all respects you may prosper and be in good health. See that? That verse is a key verse that the people who believe in the prosperity doctrine use. Can you understand why they would do that? Okay, but there's a problem with doing that. Read with me. John wishing good health to Gaius does not mean that Gaius was ill. That's the first thing. You don't, just because you say to someone, I wish you'd be, there's no indication that Gaius was ill. That's first. The wish was a conventional one, and though it does not rule out a concern for Gaius's health, it does not necessitate it. In other words, this phrase, beloved, I pray that in all respects you may prosper and be in good health, was a conventional salutation in that culture. Now, A, this is the important part. The fact that John prayed that Gaius may prosper and be in good health in no way indicates that all believers at all times should experience material prosperity and be in good health. A more reasonable inference is that John commended Gaius by praying that things will be well for his physical health as they have been for his spiritual health. Gaius was evidently an outstanding spiritual man. Now, see what the prosperity doctrine people would do would be to say, well, prosper and be in good health. If John's saying that that's what he's praying for him, then we should all prosper and be in good health. Again, the problem is, again, that's a standard salutation. And the second thing is, where this argument of the prosperity doctrine falls is this. If a believer is not prospering materially or is not in good health, how do they deal with that? Well, they deal with it by saying that believer is lacking in faith. But if that were the case, then John would not pray. He wouldn't say, I pray that you may prosper and be good health. He'd say, I pray that you have faith. Because so long as he had faith, he would prosper and be in good health. So it just doesn't, you know, there's a flaw in the argument. But this is just a common salutation. And if a believer gets ill, it is not necessarily an indication that they're not being faithful or that they don't have faith. But B, however, it is reasonable to conclude that there may be a relationship between a believer's spiritual life and physical life. And that goes in both directions. Our spiritual life can it? I mean, if we're going through a tremendous spiritual, psychological, and mental stress, it can cause, you know, digestive problems or whatever. It can have a detrimental effect on us. And the other, it goes in the other direction as well. If we don't take care of our bodies and we eat junk food all the time and we get no exercise and we get overweight and all those things, or we smoke or whatever, that can affect us in our spiritual health. It can. It goes in both directions. Our body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. And so one of the things we should do is take care of our bodies as well as our spirits. See, John's salutation indicates that he was concerned for the temporal well-being of others, not only for their spiritual welfare. He must surely have learned this from Yeshua, whose concern for people's physical troubles is attested to in all four Gospels. The influence of Yeshua on John is unfathomable. And we've seen that in a lot of the things that John says. You can tell he clearly got this from Yeshua. When we studied 1 and 2 John, we can see he was listening to Yeshua carefully when Yeshua taught and watching him carefully when he did things. D, believers today should also follow the example of Yeshua, praying for both one another's spiritual and temporal needs. We should pray for one another, and we should pray for one another's spiritual needs and for one another's temporal needs. In other words, we should pray for one another that we will be spiritually healthy, physically healthy, and that our temporal needs will be met. And that's a prayer that God will answer affirmatively because He's promised that in the Bible. So that's praying in the will of God. Okay? Okay, next. John was glad to have learned from some brothers. This is in verse 3. I was glad when the brethren came and testified the truth. John was glad to have learned from some brothers in the Lord about Gaius' loyalty to the truth. John had heard from others that Gaius was a man of truth. Okay? So, A, it is quite possible that the believers who brought this testimony to John had enjoyed Gaius' hospitality. The same thing with John apparently urged on behalf of Demetrius. In verse 10, he says, is it verse 10? No, I don't think it's... Let me see. Yeah, from verse 10, for this reason, if I come, I will call attention to his wicked deeds, which he does, unjustly accusing us with wicked words, and not satisfied with this, he himself does not receive the brethren either, and he forbids those who desire to do so and put them out of the church. So John is, in the same way as he refuted doctrine in 1 and 2 John, he refutes this behavior in 3 John. Okay. And also verse 12 would be applicable there. That's the one that is more applicable, where he commends Demetrius. Demetrius has received a good testimony from everyone and from the truth itself, and we add our testimony and know that our testimony is true. And, you know, going back to 8, therefore we ought to support such men so that we may be fellow workers with them. So, what apparently happened here was John heard from believers that Gaius was a godly man who showed hospitality to traveling preachers, and now he's asking for him to show the same kind of hospitality to this man Demetrius, and he's giving Demetrius a commendation, because we know that we have to be careful about hospitality. Remember what we saw in 2 John? Not to give hospitality to the false teachers. So here he's kind of giving him like a letter of recommendation. Okay. B, the words "how you are walking in the truth" in verse 3 elaborate what the brothers had said about Gaius. Gaius' style of life, that's what his walk is. That's what our walk is. It's our style of life, was consistent with God's truth. As a believer walks in God's truth, and again, what that means is as our style of life reflects the teachings of the Bible. That's what that means there, to walk. You know, the word walk is being used figuratively, obviously. As a believer walks in God's truth and loves his brothers, it's one, you know, it's, you can't separate those two concepts. His reputation as a godly man will spread within the community of believers, and opportunities for service will increase. Now look what happens with Gaius here. Here's a man who's a godly man walking in the truth. He has a godly reputation. And what's actually happening here because of that,
You might look at it as though John's asking Gaius to do something that is inconvenient. But actually, he's blessing Gaius and giving him an opportunity to bear fruit. See? So, as we walk in the truth, we bear fruit, and we're giving additional opportunities to bear more fruit. Now, someone might ask, well, what's my ministry? There are people who have a gift of hospitality. I've met people like that. Well, here's a short little, you can memorize this, or you can jot it down, or you can just think about it. But here's we know what our ministry is. First of all, let me say, it can change from time to time. You know, God may have us doing one thing in one place at one time, and then he may move us on to something else. So it can change from time to time. But basically speaking, the way we know what our ministry is, first, we walk in the truth. We obey the commands of the Scripture, and we love one another. That's the beginning. If we're not doing that, there's no way we can know what our ministry is. Of course, our ministry has to involve that. Then, as we're doing that, look for opportunities to serve. Within your congregation, keep your eyes open. Be creative. Gee, you know, I think what we could use in our congregation is a 12-step program. Pastor says, that sounds like a good idea. A lot of people need that kind of thing now. Why don't you head it up? So you look for opportunities to serve. Become familiar with the spiritual gifts and know what yours are. Know what your gifts are, also your talents and your abilities. Be familiar with, you know, there's some people who make great youth pastors, and some people who know, I'm not good at that. I'm better at relating to adults than youth. Next, be aware of God's leading. He will plant desires in your heart as you go through this process. And then finally, am I moving too fast for anybody? Receive counsel from wise, mature believers who have served the Lord for some period of time. That's always valuable. And especially those who know you well. So that's a little, you know, mini lesson on how we can discern what our current ministry should be. But notice where it begins. It begins with obeying God's commandments and loving one another. That has to be the foundation, because that's what ministry is. And if we're not doing that, we are not eligible. I don't want to say we're not eligible for ministry. We need to correct that to become eligible for ministry. Okay, C. Nothing made John happier than to hear that his children, notice how affectionately he refers to the believers whom he oversees, were walking in the truth. And this wording is similar to that in 2 John 4. I was very glad that some of your children, to find some of your children walking in truth, just as we have received commandment to do from the Father. So this made John joyful. And why? Remember we talked about it? If they're walking in the truth, let me say it this way. If they're not, he feels that he's responsible. Remember we talked about that? John feels, and Paul felt the same way. Okay, next. It is possible that by referring to Gaius as one of his children, John meant that he had led Gaius to the Lord. That's a possibility. Paul uses that type of terminology. Paul uses this idea in 1 Corinthians 4:14, Galatians 4:19, and Philippians 2:22. So it's possible that John had led Gaius to the Lord. We can't be certain, but that's a possibility. Even if this was not the case, it demonstrates that John had a loving, fatherly concern towards those to whom he ministered. Believers today should follow John and Yeshua's example of having a loving concern for the brothers and sisters in the Lord. And most especially, if you lead someone to the Lord, you have a responsibility for that person's welfare. Because they're a baby, and you're not. And so if you lead someone to the Lord, you have a responsibility to encourage them to become part of a congregation. Maybe your own. You know, bring them into your congregation. You have a responsibility to share with them basic messianic truths. You have a responsibility to watch out for them and protect them, in a sense, from false teaching. And you have a responsibility to lovingly keep them accountable. Because if you lead someone to the Lord and just forget about them, I don't think that pleases the Lord. Remember that old proverb I told you about, the Japanese proverb? If you save a man's life, you're then responsible for his life. And essentially, when we lead someone to the Lord, their life is being saved. And now we share in the responsibility for that life. Okay, moving on. Verses 5 through 8. Any questions so far? That was pretty much the salutation. Okay, verses 5 through 8. Beloved, you are acting faithfully in whatever you accomplish for the brethren, especially when they are strangers. And they have testified to your love before the church. You will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God, for they went out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. Therefore, we ought to support such men so that we may be fellow workers with the truth. That's the heart of 3 John. That's the heart of 3 John. Those verses right there. That's the truth that John is expressing in 3 John. Now, I was going to deal with a behavioral issue related to that truth. Okay, so let's see if we can unpack that truth a little bit. After commending the godly conduct of Gaius, John moves directly to a matter that concerned him. Those who go forth to preach the truth need the support of believers in the places where they travel. That's just a fact. If you're going to travel around preaching the gospel, that's going to pretty much eliminate you from having some kind of full-time job somewhere, isn't it? And so you're going to be dependent upon others for your support. And it's not only John who says that. What did Paul say? Those who preach the gospel should make their living by the gospel. And when in Matthew 10:10, when Yeshua sent his disciples out, look what he said. Matthew 10:10, let me read it. I don't want to paraphrase it. He said this. When he sent them out, he said, "Do not acquire gold or silver or copper for your money, belts or a bag for your journey, or even two coats or sandals or a staff, for the worker is worthy of his support." He's saying, you're going on a trip now, don't get a footlocker full of gold and clothing and food. You're worthy of your support. Now watch how he follows it up. And whatever city or village you enter, inquire who is worthy in it. In other words, find a believer, find it, you know, and stay at his house until you leave that city. So that's the basis upon which John heard Yeshua say this, obviously. And this is a basic principle. A church, if a traveling preacher comes to a church, like when I go on tour, the churches I speak at, they give me hospitality. Somebody in the church opens their home for me. And that's the way it should be. And feeds me. Don't buy me clothes, but... Okay, now, A, unlike Diotrephes, Gaius gave this kind of assistance, and John assured him he was doing the right thing. See when he says, "Beloved, you are acting faithfully"? John didn't want to leave any possibility that Gaius could say, "Well, maybe Diotrephes is right." It appears as Gaius knew that he wasn't. But John doesn't want to leave that possibility open. So John gives him assurance that his behavior is right, as opposed to Diotrephes. B, this contrasts
with the emphasis in 2 John 10 and 11 on not giving hospitality to false teachers. So there's a contrast here. We should not give hospitality to false teachers. We should give hospitality to true teachers. Okay? Now, how do we know? Well, one way to know is obviously by a recommendation. Right? John is recommending Demetrius to Gaius. And John, obviously, you know, if you wanted to get, you know, if you were applying for a job in a church back in those days and you want to get a letter of recommendation, you get one from John, you're pretty much in, right? Okay. So one way is the reputation among believers, what the believers say about these people. Secondly, enter into discussion, conversation with the person. See whether, you know, what do they believe? Why are they here? What is it they want to accomplish? You know, I'm not saying interrogate them, but have a lively conversation with them over a period of time. Also, generally speaking, if someone comes into your congregation and then becomes a part of your congregation and makes, you know, potentially they may make that move from just being a member to being more, you know, in a position of teaching authority, so forth, that should not happen quickly. The person who comes into your congregation, who's a new member, you want to take your time, and by you I mean the congregation, the others, and observe the way that person lives and what they really believe over some period of time, so that when you come to the point where you say, this is a person who, maybe the pastor says, this is a person who maybe could be a deacon or even an elder, they have a track record. Very dangerous to have somebody come into your congregation who's very well spoken, blah, 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 and a month later they're an elder. That's not wise. Okay? Okay, C. No, I did see D. The good that believers do for one another and for God will be rewarded by God. So you see, showing hospitality is not an inconvenience. It's an opportunity for a reward. And look what it says. He who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. If a traveling preacher comes to your congregation and you take them into your house and give them a room, that's the equivalent of having Yeshua stay at your house. Think about it. If there was a knock on your door and you opened the door and there he was, showed you the whole thing, he said, can I stay at your house for a little while? You said, stay as long as you want. Move in. That's how we should treat traveling preachers. And he who receives a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. Okay, moving on. Next page. And whoever in the name of a disciple gives one of these little ones even a cup of cold water to drink, truly I say to you, he shall not lose his reward. You know, think about something. If there's a traveling preacher and he comes by and he stops at your house and says, I'm on my way from here to here and I'm just a little tired and hungry. Can I come and rest a little bit and maybe wash up? And do you have some little something I can to sustain me? And you invite them in, make them a sandwich, let them, you know, maybe take a little nap, so forth, and then maybe even give them some, you know, a donation to support them on their way. The whole thing could take an hour. Now God's involved in holding the whole universe together, right? But He doesn't forget that. He remembers that. And you will get a reward for that. You will not lose it. God will not forget what you have done, that little thing you've done, in spite of the fact that He has to know where every star is by name. You will receive a reward for that. Now read this with me. Very nice. Now when Yeshua was in Bethany at the home of Simon the leper, a woman came to him with an alabaster vial of very costly perfume, and she poured it upon his head as he reclined at the table. But the disciples were indignant when they saw this and said, "Why this waste? This was very costly. For this perfume might have been sold for a high price and the money given to the poor." But Yeshua, aware of this, said to them, "Why do you bother the woman? For she has done a good deed for me. For the poor you will always, you will have with you always, but you do not always have me." In other words, he's saying you always have an opportunity to give to the poor, and you should, but you don't always have an opportunity to minister to me. "For when she poured this perfume upon my body, she did it to prepare me for burial." And this is my favorite part of this verse. Listen to this. "Truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done shall also be spoken in memory of her." And how is that accomplished? It's recorded in the Bible. Isn't that neat? I mean, what an honor for that woman. We don't know who she was, but God knows who she was, and she knows who she was. And one day we'll all know who she was. Dracked. Unless this is an emergency. Can everybody ignore this? I forgot to turn my phone off. Okay, next, in Revelation. "And I heard a voice from heaven saying, Write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on, yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow with them." The good deeds that you do in the Lord follow with you. In other words, it's another way of saying you will not lose your reward. All right, this is off now. Okay, 2. "It is possible that the reason John commended Gaius' hospitality is that his conduct was in contrast with what others in the congregation did. This may have been the reason Gaius experienced the displeasure of some in the congregation." Remember when we mentioned that John said, "Whom I love in the truth"? There is the possibility, there's actually two possibilities. One possibility is that there was no dissension in the congregation. Everybody's just following Diotrephes, and that's the way they're behaving. And they're afraid of Diotrephes. The other possibility is that there's a little bit of a schism going here, because there's those who don't like what Diotrephes is doing. But apparently, if Gaius is one of those who is acting contrary to what Gaius is saying, then it makes sense that those who follow Gaius, Diotrephes, are not going to be too pleased with Gaius. See it? And so, his hospitality may have caused him to be maligned and treated poorly by members of the congregation. Now, what do we do if that happens to us? If we're living our lives and believers in our congregation come and start to treat us poorly, rebuking us, dissatisfied with us, very simple. You ask them, "What is the problem you have with me, with what I'm doing or what I'm saying?" Listen to what they say and take what they say and then filter it through the scriptures and your behavior. If what they say is in line with what this Bible says, and then you discover I'm not living this way, then even if they didn't rebuke you in a loving way, you still have a responsibility to change. They should do it in a loving way. However, if what they say, when you filter it through the scriptures and your behavior, you say, "Wait, in the scriptures it says this is the way I ought to be, and this is the way I have been," then you needn't be overly disturbed about this. And quite often, to tell you the truth, the best strategy that you can use against that
is the strategy Yeshua used when he was put on trial. Just don't argue back with them. Remember, Yeshua didn't put up a defense. He didn't get into, you know, he spoke the truth, but he didn't put up a big defense. And it was prophecy that he would not open his mouth. That's usually the best strategy, because doing otherwise can just pour gasoline on the fire. Let the fire go out. Generally speaking, and this is a basic rule of thumb, if a bully comes to bully you and you don't allow and you don't submit yourself to his bullying, he'll go find somebody else. Okay. 3. Now, read verse 5 with me again. Verse 5, beloved, you are acting faithfully in whatever you accomplish for the brethren, and especially when they are strangers. The NASB and the NIV adopt the construction of verse 5 that equates brothers with strangers. You see that? For the brethren, especially when they are strangers. And there should be some italics there, because it's not really a literal rendering. But many manuscripts read for the brothers and for strangers. So it's two different groups, not just the one. Thus, Gaius' hospitality did not stop with traveling believers who were known to him, but also extended to believers who were unknown to him. Hebrews 13:2 discusses the believer's responsibility to show hospitality to strangers. We should never underestimate the significance of an act of love shown toward another. And it says in Hebrews 13:2, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. So if somebody comes and they're a stranger, you still show them hospitality. Now, of course, there's still the guidelines. If they're a stranger, you want to have a, you know, ascertain that they are, in fact, in the faith, that they're a believer, you know, that they're a believer, that they, you know, you don't want to give hospitality, as it says in 2 John, to false teachers and so forth. So you do want to be wise, but the fact that that person is not known to you doesn't eliminate them from hospitality, especially if they come and they're given a commendation from a reliable source and so forth. Okay. Continuing, John's statement, you are acting faithfully in whatever you accomplish for the brothers, indicates that Gaius' behavior was praiseworthy because it is an act of fidelity to the truth of God. Again, as in 2 John 1 and 2, love is founded on truth. And we discussed that just a little bit earlier. In the world, I mean, I remember I once heard Madonna on an interview saying, all we have to do is love one another. Everybody love one another. And she probably meant what she was saying, but the fact of the matter is, what she was saying, knowing what I know about her, and I don't want to judge her, was not based on the truth. You know, it was just some flowery thing, and I'm sure she wants to be a loving person, but if it's not grounded on God's truth, it won't be agape. It'll be human. And so we have to base our love on God's truth. Otherwise, at the very best, is some kind of human benevolence that has self in mind at some point. The report of Gaius' hospitality had reached the congregation where John now was. Verse 6. Okay? They have testified to your love before the church. Okay. This may well have been the congregation at Jerusalem if the letter was written before 66 CE. Remember we said John at this time probably was in Jerusalem? Perhaps these brothers had returned to Gaius' vicinity carrying a letter from John and once again needed hospitality. Okay. Now, this is interesting. Here, we're going to put this in a cultural context. You see where it says, you will do well in verse 6.
you will do well to send them on the way, manner of the worthy of God. We've got to put that in its cultural context. First of all, you will do well was an idiom back then that meant please. That's what it meant in that culture. And it expresses a polite request. So John is asking him to do this. He's not telling him this. I mean, it is the right thing to do, but he's asking him to do this. Okay, now continue with me. The verb for send them on their way, again in that culture, carried in general usage the connotation of making adequate provision for one's guests, both while they stayed and at the time of their departure. This would involve supplying them with food and money to pay for their expenses, washing their clothes, and generally helping them to travel as comfortably as possible. That's what, in that culture, what that meant. There are various ways in which such help can be given, and John wanted it to be offered in a way that would please God and be worthy of one who gives generously and richly to his servants. So you can see hospitality in biblical times was a little different than hospitality now. You know the story of the servant, Abraham's servant, who went to find a wife for Isaac and came upon Rebecca? And remember the hospitality they showed him? And right away her reaction, we have room, we have place, we have food, come. That's the way that culture was back then. And that's the way we should be towards believers. If a traveling preacher comes our way and we give them hospitality, when it's time for them to leave, we send them on their way. And what that means is we make sure that they're adequately provided for so they can reach their next destination comfortably. Okay. C. Let's just do C. John's admonition to send them on their way in a manner of God shows the supreme importance assigned to hospitality. The phrase probably means that traveling brothers were to be recognized as servants of God and supported as such. Fellow believers should be provided hospitality as though the Lord himself were being welcomed. That's the idea here. Nothing less than hospitality and generosity is worthy of God, who expressed his extreme generosity in the giving of his Son. Our model for being generous, and here it's being applied to hospitality, is God's giving of his Son. That's the supreme model of generosity. So if a traveling preacher comes and stays with me and the total cost to me is $30 worth of food, compare that to God giving his Son. It's a pittance. So we should be generous in our hospitality. Truly, truly, I say to you, whomever I send receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. I think we've already seen that. Okay, time for our break. Okay, we're on page 84 in the notes. Continue reading with me. While traveling missionaries needed to beware of the temptation of making a good thing out of their work. You know, you don't want to be a traveling missionary and take advantage. That would be wrong. And congregations had to be aware of being taken in by charlatans. Because there are people who might travel around saying, hey, I can get this is a meal ticket. You know what I mean? Who are really not missionaries. It was perhaps more important to remind the congregations not to treat missionaries like beggars and so discredit the name of God to whom they were looking for support. In other words, our approach should be, I'm going to give hospitality unless it's clearly indicated that hospitality should not be given, rather than I'm going to withhold hospitality unless and until I am certain that it should be given. Make sense? Okay. The point is still relevant today. Messianic ministers and missionaries live in the faith that God will encourage his people to provide for their needs. It is therefore better that such provisions err on the side of generosity than on the side of stinginess. God loves a cheerful giver. Okay, next. The idea of supplying God's servants with provisions for the journey also appears in Acts 15 and Titus 3:13. And when Paul and Barnabas had great dissension and debate with them, the brethren determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain others of them should go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders concerning this issue. You know, the issue was Gentiles becoming part of the people of God. Therefore, being sent on their way, there's that phrase, by the church, they were passing through both Phoenicia and Samaria, describing in detail the conversion of the Gentiles, and were bringing great joy to all the brethren. So in other words, when Paul and Barnabas left, they just didn't say goodbye to them. They gave them adequate provision to get them to their destination. They sent them on their way. And then Titus 3:13, diligently help Zenas the lawyer and Apollos on their way, so that nothing is lacking for them. So this isn't just picking one verse out of the Bible and making a doctrine out of it. This current runs all through the scriptures. 6. John's appeal to Gaius rests on the fact that missionaries are wholly dependent on God's people for their support. They do not or should not receive... Now listen, this is important. Let me read this and get this. This is important. They, that's the missionaries, do not or should not receive support from the people with whom they share the gospel. That we should not do. If you're sharing the gospel with a group of non-believers, you should not solicit support from them. In verses 7 and 8, three specific reasons are given for the hospitality John is asking Gaius to extend to traveling ministers of the world. Let me say this, it's in the notes, but just so we can get it out of the way right now. The reason you don't do that, if I'm preaching the gospel to a group of non-believers, like at a crusade, and then I take an offering, it somewhat diminishes the free gift of salvation. It's no longer free. See what I'm saying? So we don't want to solicit funds from those with whom we share the gospel. A, first these brothers went out for the sake of the name. The name refers to Yeshua the Messiah, whose name is now exalted above every other name. To go out on behalf of that name was a supreme honor. And notice what it says. Therefore, also God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every other name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. So when you go out, you know, it's something like, suppose somebody knocked on your door and showed you credentials that they were representing President Obama. I know some of us might not like his political stance, but I'm just using an illustration. President Reagan, I think everybody likes him. You know, this is a dignitary. This is somebody you really want. It's an honor to show hospitality to them. Well, what's being said here is these traveling preachers, they're dignitaries of God, of the Lord, of the name. It's an honor to show hospitality to them, not an inconvenience. Okay. So they went on their way from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they had been considered worthy to be suffer shame for his name. That's how precious the name is. Do they not blaspheme the fair name by which you have been called? And the name is Yeshua. Okay, B. And again, what we're discussing here is John's appeal to Gaius. Okay? So first we saw part of the appeal is, number one, they're going out preaching the gospel, representing Yeshua. So that's one reason for showing them hospitality. Second, they took nothing from non-believing Gentiles. It was inappropriate for God's messengers to seek support from those who did not believe in or honor that name. That's what I mentioned before. This principle applies today. There is something unseemly about a preacher soliciting funds from those to whom he is offering God's free salvation. See that? One, in not claiming support from the people with whom they shared the gospel, missionaries are motivated by Yeshua's principle, freely you have received, freely give. To take payment for the gospel would be to nullify the offer of free grace. It turns salvation into salvation by works. Two, that they could make no preparation and accept nothing from pagans shows how strongly John's community depended on the words of Yeshua. And he instructed them that they should take nothing for the journey except a mere staff, no bread, no bag, no money in their belt, but to wear sandals. And he added, do not put on two tunics. And he said to them, wherever you enter a house, stay there until you leave town. Yeshua was saying to them, rely on the people of God for your support, not on unbelievers. C, the right of people to receive the gospel for nothing does not absolve those who have received the free gift from the responsibility of supporting the messianic mission and sharing their material goods with those who give them spiritual instruction. See the difference? So, a great illustration is your generosity to me today, which I'm flabbergasted, was God will remember that. God will remember that. And I will too in heaven. I'm going to come up to each one of you and say to you, thank you for what you did back when we were on earth. But God is going to say to you, that was very nice what you did for this fellow who's stumbling through the word with you. Yes? Wait, where is it? B? Right. Second, they took nothing from non-believing Gentiles. It was inappropriate for God's messengers to seek support from those who did not believe in or honor that name. Who did not... Oh, I have did believe? Oh, I didn't even see it the second time. Let me write that. Good, thank you. That's a typo. Did not, but should say did not. Everybody see that? Okay, C. The right of people to receive the gospel for nothing... I already read that. Okay, but let me finish it up. There is a difference between demanding payment for the gospel and encouraging those whose hearts have been transformed by grace to show their thanks for God's generosity to missionaries in tangible form. Okay, so continuing. Yes?
Do you get to the fact also that when you offer hospitality, you have this marvelous... special time, man on man, to really grow in the Lord by sharing.
Well, that's part of what I'm saying when I'm saying it's an opportunity. But your point is well taken, and thank you for sharing that. If you show hospitality to a traveling preacher, you have an opportunity to avail yourself of his teaching and to fellowship with him and pray with him. So it's a blessing. And break bread with him. And possibly celebrate the Lord's Supper. Thank you. That's a good point. I'm going to bring that up in the evening class. That's good insight. Okay. Page 86. Just some verses to confirm this. If we sowed spiritual things in you, is it too much if we should reap material things from you? And let the one who has taught the word share all good things with him who teaches. So also the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel. Okay, see, third basis upon which John bases his appeal. Third, it was through hospitality believers... I got two tenses there. It shouldn't say was and then can be. It is through hospitality that believers can become fellow workers for the truth. Those who pray for and support messianic ministries become partners with that ministry. Therefore, there is a blessing for both the giver and the receiver. Let me give you an illustration. I'm a missionary to the Jewish people. I have people who support me. When I go out in an effort to share the word with Jewish people, they are standing with me. And it says in Genesis chapter 12, I will bless those who bless you. Now, what greater giving blessing is there that we can give the Jewish people than to share the gospel with them? And I believe that those who support Jewish ministries, God will bless them for it. And other ministries as well. That was just an illustration. Okay. Now, verses 9 and 10. I wrote something to the church. Now, here's where we get into the problem. I wrote something to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first among them, does not accept what we say. For this reason, if I come, I will call attention to his deeds which he does, unjustly accusing us with wicked words. And not satisfied with this, he himself does not receive the brethren either, but he forbids those who desire to do so and puts them out of the church. So you see what happened there. John had written a letter to this church about this, but Diotrephes rejected it. And not only did he reject it, but he was slandering John and his followers, and he was threatening people, if you follow John's teaching, you're gone. So this is the issue John wants to address. You can see how serious this is. This is not a minor thing here. Not everyone shared John's worthy objective, including Diotrephes, the leader of the congregation. John had already addressed a letter to the congregation through Diotrephes. That letter is lost, perhaps destroyed by Diotrephes himself. Okay. Why? Money? Power? We don't know, but we know that Diotrephes was not loving based on the truth. That's clear. A. The letter's contents, however, are not difficult to imagine. On the basis of what John wrote Gaius, we can surmise that he had written the congregation asking them to extend hospitality to the traveling missionaries he had sent out. Diotrephes chose to thwart John's intention either by suppressing the letter or opposing the request before the congregation. So there's the tension. There's the problem. We've seen the way things should be, and now we see there's a problem because they're not the way they should be. So let's see how John's going to deal with this now. Okay, B. Exactly how Gaius fits into all this is unclear. Now, there's two possibilities. I believe, well, let's read them, and then I'll tell you which one I think is more likely. If Gaius were from the same church as Diotrephes, why would John be telling Gaius about what Diotrephes was doing when presumably Gaius would know about it firsthand? So that's an argument for maybe Gaius wasn't from that church. That Diotrephes loves to be first among them, plural, may indicate that Diotrephes had influence over or is attempting to influence other congregations in the area. See it? It is possible that Gaius was the leader, that he should be the, of one of the congregations, and on that basis, John writes to him. So that's one possibility that we can get from the text. That's not the one that I lean towards, but it is a possibility. Now, C is the one that I think is more likely. It is also possible that Gaius was a member of the same church as Diotrephes and John, Diotrephes, comma, because it reads like John was a member of that church too. And John, having had his first letter suppressed by Diotrephes, wrote a second letter to Gaius, hoping that he would share it with the church. Or perhaps Gaius lived in a nearby village, perhaps a day's journey away, and therefore did not know all that was taking place in the congregation. That's another possibility. This would explain the significance of his house as a stopping place for missionaries during their travels. In other words, missionaries who are traveling to this church, when they get like a day away from the church, they stay at Gaius's house, and then they go the next day to the church. So maybe he lived too far away from the church to be really in the know of the daily goings-on. Possibility. D. So strongly did Diotrephes oppose John's request that he threatened the expulsion of any in the congregation who were considering hospitality to John's emissaries. In fact, some may already have been forced out of the congregation. He was threatening them with excommunication, throwing them out of the church. I mean, this guy was really like a power broker. Think about it if you were doing something, you know, your pastor came to you and said, you keep doing that, you can't come to this church anymore. That's big. And that's what he was doing. Okay. One comment I'd like to make. You see where he says Diotrephes, who loves to be first? That gives us a clue as to the motivation. Power. right? Position. But what did the Lord say? The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. We're not to love to be first. What we should love is to be servants. So we're given a pretty good clue there as to where this Diotrephes is coming from. It's a power issue, and John obviously is an authoritative person in the church, and so Diotrephes, you can see why he would have a problem with John, because he wants to be the man. See it? F. That there was a deeper split, perhaps involving theological differences, is not supported in the text. So this is not like an incarnation issue like we saw in 1st and 2nd John. The conflict is not between two types of belief. It is between two levels of commitment to the work of God. Diotrephes was more interested in furthering his own position than in furthering the work of God. So this is not, as in 1st and 2nd John, issues of heretical teaching. This was issues of, let me say it this way, truthful teaching not being applied. Okay? Okay, next. G. Diotrephes is a standing warning against the danger of confusing personal ambition with zeal for the cause of the gospel. While there is no suggestion that Diotrephes disagreed with John on any vital point of doctrine, he surely did not express his adherence to the truth in love. And if you want to, you can go back and read 2 John 4:6. It expresses something very similar to what's being said here. But in a sense, what we can see here is that there is a sense in which what we call doctrine and truth and the way we behave are inseparable. Diotrephes, there's nothing to indicate Diotrephes was a heretic. There's nothing to indicate he disagreed with John on any doctrinal issue. But obviously, doctrine simply means teaching. Remember we mentioned that. And certainly, he didn't agree with all that John taught, because John taught that we should be hospitable. And it's based on the truth. It's based on the example of Yeshua. So even if he didn't have doctrinal deficiencies in his theology, he wasn't practicing what he either knew to be true or disregarded, you know. So we don't want to separate doctrine from behavior. The two do go hand in hand. Truth from behavior. H. Not only was Diotrephes opposing John's request for hospitality for traveling missionaries, he was also slandering John and his emissaries in an attempt to tear down the reputation of those whom he was not willing to receive. He was slandering them. That's very serious. This wasn't gossip. See, gossip is, I go to you and tell you something about her that's true, but that my telling you hurts her. Okay? See it? That's gossip. Maybe she did something wrong and I know about it, and I guess I'll go telling people about it. I'm telling the truth, but I'm gossiping, and that's wrong. Slander is, I tell you something about her that's hurtful to her, that's a lie. That's even more serious. And what Diotrephes was doing was slanderous. So it was very serious. He was slandering John, and in doing so, discrediting the emissaries he was sending, right? What good is a letter of recommendation from John if John's no good? Diotrephes, that's his strategy. Okay. John knew that it was necessary to deal with this matter in person. He hoped to visit the area before long. The translation, "If I come, I will call attention to what he is doing," is too mild. It's stronger in the original language. John intends to take up the matter with him and seek satisfaction about him. This is strong language. Remember, John when we read the Gospel of John and 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, we get the impression he was a very gentle, peaceful man. And I agree with that. But remember, he was one of the sons of thunder. He was not a timid man, especially in regards to his best friend, Yeshua. Bear in mind, all of this, John took offense because it reflected on his best friend, Yeshua. And so John was, I imagine when John got there, as peaceful and as humble as he was, he was going to have his say and was not going to be timid about it. Okay, next. Presumably, John intended to do this on a personal level first rather than in the congregation. That's the way it should be done. In other words, first he would approach Diotrephes in private, or possibly with Gaius. No, probably first in private. If Diotrephes did not completely repent, then John would in all likelihood expose his conduct before the whole congregation. It would be necessary. And that's pretty much in line with Yeshua's teaching. If you offend me in some way, first I go to you in private. And I attempt to win you back, right? If you don't respond, then I go, what, with two or three, so that every word can be established. And if you still won't repent, then bring it before the congregation. And that probably doesn't mean the whole congregation. It probably means the elders. It probably indicates the elders. Okay. Two, there seems to be an implication that Diotrephes' deeds were not fully known to the congregation, and perhaps it was John's hope that once they were revealed, the congregation would either censor or expel Diotrephes from his position. J, in any case, it is wrong to refrain exercising legitimate authority when there is a need to do so. That's very important for us to remember. The modern church is perhaps too cautious in exercising brotherly admonitions and even discipline when it is required. Discipline is an important part of love, and churches today don't exercise it or exercise it improperly, harshly. I have a friend who once went on a trip, and he asked me and my wife to take care of the children. They had four children when they went on a trip. He was a pastor, by the way. This is when I lived somewhere else. And we were going to just take care of their kids. And it turned out, first of all, their house was just a disaster area. And the kids, everything was, it was catastrophic. It was just unbelievable. And we finally went to the elders and said, we're having trouble. We're running into problems here. And the elders came and they saw what was going on. So he cut short his trip and came back. And the elders dealt with him in love and helped him to, you know, show them the error of his ways. And he did the right thing, you know, straightened things out. And one of the members of the church, who was a close brother of this pastor, said, you know something? I saw this. I knew this a long time ago, but I've never wanted to say anything to you because I love you. And you know what the pastor said to him? You don't love me. If you loved me, you would have told me. So, just an illustration. Okay, verses 11 and 12. Beloved, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. The one who does good is of God. The one who does evil has not seen God. Sounds a little bit like 1 John, doesn't it? Demetrius has received a good testimony from everyone and from the truth itself, and we add our testimony, and you know that our testimony is true. There's the commendation of Demetrius, the traveling preacher. Okay, let's read. In verse 11, John encourages Gaius to imitate what is good rather than what is evil. The position of the sentence and the order of the words strongly suggest that Diotrephes is the evil example and the good example is typified by Demetrius, who is mentioned in the next verse. You see that? How that works? How first, you know, in verse 10, he rebukes the behavior of Diotrephes, and then in verse 11, he gives the principle. Do not imitate what is evil. That's Diotrephes' behavior. but what is good, and that's Demetrius in verse 12. So he's saying, don't follow the example of Diotrephes, follow the example of Demetrius, basically speaking. Okay. A. The verse is thus basically an appeal to Gaius not to be misled by Diotrephes and follow his example, even if he may be placed under considerable personal pressure to conform to Diotrephes' instructions. To give in to pressure against one's convictions is to submit to evil. So you can see how serious that is. Although John was confident regarding Gaius' attitude, he commended him in verse 5 and 6, he felt it was wise to enforce it. In other words, when something's really important, let's suppose there's something that you really should be doing, and you're being pressured not to do it. If I'm a leader in the church, I have a responsibility to commend you for it and to encourage you to keep doing it, because I'm responsible for your welfare, and that's part of my ministry to you. That's part of my ministry to you. In a sense, I'm protecting you from the pressure that's being put on you. Okay, now this is interesting. Read A. A chiasmus is a reversal in the order of words in two otherwise parallel phrases, as in, now here's an example of a chiasmus. He went to the country, to the town went she. See how it reversed? Verse 11 forms a chiasmus, evil, good, good, evil, which emphasizes the force of John's wording. That's the purpose of a chiasmus, for emphasis. And look at it, what it says here, where he says in verse 11, do not imitate what evil is evil, but what is good. The one who is good is from God. The one who does evil has not seen God. See the chiasmus in there? And see how it gives it further emphasis? The words of God, in the NIV, it's from God, translate the Greek phrase ektaltheo, which occurs a number of times in 1 John. It suggests that the source of one's actions or attitudes is in God. Conversely, anyone who does evil has not seen God. With this, the statement in 1 John 3:6 should be compared. That's where he's talking about the one who sins, I'm going to paraphrase, knows God, the one who... No, the one... Let's read it so I don't... What is it? 1 John 3:6. It's very similar, but no one who abides in him sins. No one who sins has seen him or knows him. It's another chiasmus. And it's very similar in thought. Here he's talking, in 1 John, he's talking about sin in general. In 3 John, he's addressing, again, evil versus good, which is, in a sense, parallel to sin versus righteousness. So the doctrinal principle from 1 John is being kind of spilled over into the behavioral conflict in 3 John. So we see there is a relationship between truth and behavior here. Okay, where were we? C. John was not questioning Diotrephes' salvation. There's nothing to indicate that he was an unsaved man. But he was affirming that Diotrephes' conduct manifested real blindness toward God. Gaius was to avoid such an experience as this. So as strong as John's words are, there's nothing in the text to indicate that Diotrephes was not a saved man. What is indicated was he was not behaving as a saved man should. Okay? And we can be fairly certain that if Diotrephes were teaching heresy, John would mention it. Okay. In verse 11, John appeals to examples because the nature of God's revelation that truth, love, and righteousness have been modeled first in Messiah and then by those who are faithful to his commandments. So, in verse 11,
he has the examples. The one who does good is of God. Again, this is not a salvation issue. I mean, it may be, but basically what he's speaking is the one who does good is doing good because they're of God. They're related to God. They're walking with God. They're obeying God. See? It's not really so much a salvation issue, but a relationship issue. The one who does evil has not seen God. Again, it's not necessarily a salvation issue, but if you're acting in an evil way, when it says has not seen God, well, we know no one's seen God, but it's saying you really haven't entered into a healthy paternal relationship with Him. So I think from John's point of view, the issue here is not saved versus not saved. It's right living versus wrong living. Right living is an indication that you do have a relationship with God, and wrong living is an indication your relationship with God is not as it should be, and we've seen that in 1st and 2nd John already. The health of your relationship is reflected by how you live. Okay. One, humanity does not have in its nature a dependable standard by which to judge itself. That's one of the problems in our culture. Situation ethics. That's how our culture lives. It must always measure its understandings and actions by God Himself, for whom love, truth, and righteousness are absolute attributes. That's why this is so important. This is the final authority on how a person should live their life. Truth, righteousness, goodness, they're not relative terms, they're absolutes. So the relativism of today is contrary to the teachings of Scripture. Morality is absolute. Two, to show them forth in our lives proves that we are from God. All goodness proceeds from God. Our perseverance in goodness demonstrates that in Messiah we have seen God. Okay? Two, in verse 12, John introduces the figure of Demetrius. He is undoubtedly meant as an example of the good which Gaius is to imitate. But the real reason for mentioning him here at the end of the main part of the letter is to write a note of condemnation for him to Gaius. It's like a letter of recommendation when you're applying for a job. A, it is possible that Demetrius was the bearer of the letter and also probable that he was a traveling missionary, possibly one of the group which had been made unwelcome by Diotrephes. So you can see what might have happened here. Demetrius may have gone to this church and Diotrephes may have refused him hospitality. And, you know, during his travels, Demetrius comes back and he goes to John. He says to John, I'm going to go in that, there again, in that direction. And when I get there, I ran into a problem. And now John is dealing with it because he wants to send Demetrius back to this church to minister again, but he wants him to receive hospitality. So he has to deal with the issue. Okay, B, he was, however, a stranger to Gaius. That's significant. And in the present situation, John judged he needed to commend Gaius, even though Gaius was known to welcome strangers. In accordance with the Jewish law of witness in Deuteronomy, you know the law of witness, two or three witnesses? In other words, if you're accused of a crime, there have to be corroborating witnesses. That's the law of witnesses in Deuteronomy 19:15. John produced a threefold testimony to the character of Demetrius. Okay, so he's kind of like, here's a Jewish man who is used to living under the law. One, he was well spoken of by everyone who knew him. That's one witness. Two, he was vouched for by the truth itself. Here the truth is personified as a witness, and John no doubt meant that Demetrius' character and doctrine were in such conformity with the truth that the truth itself virtually spoke on his behalf. That's a very strong witness and a very interesting way of John testifying to the godly character of Demetrius. And then three, a third line of testimony, John wrote, we also bear witness, the we is John and the members of his congregation, and you know that our witness is true.
John himself could personally testify to the worth of Demetrius. So here John is, in a sense, following a principle in the Mosaic law with this threefold witness when he gives him this commendation. C, the Demetrius of this letter is not to be confused with the Demetrius of Acts 19:24, who was an enemy of the gospel. So we want to be careful about that. There's another Demetrius in Acts, not the same person. Okay, because that Demetrius was an enemy of the gospel. Okay, verses 13 through... Oh, I want to show you a mistake. Go to the very beginning of the outline. Go to page... I'll tell you where to go. Go to page 78 real quick. 78. There's a little typo that we should correct, just so you have it right. Page 78. Everybody 78? You see where Roman numeral 3, farewell, verses 13 to 14? It should be verses 13 to 15. 3 John has 15 verses. So you just want to correct that little typo. Okay, let's go read 13 to 15 now. I had many things to write to you, but I am not willing to write them to you with pen and ink. But I hope to see you shortly, and we will speak face to face. Peace be with you. The friends greet you. Greet the friends by name. So apparently John's intention here is, what's he going to do? He's going to go first, where? To talk with Gaius. He has to get fully informed about what's going on, to see what Gaius has done about it, if anything, what the results were, so he's prepared for what he may have to do. He wants first a private consultation with Gaius, which is wise. We want to be fully informed and think before we speak. Yes? Oh, did you have something you want to say? I can't hear what you're saying.
There is no verse 15.
There's no verse 15. In my book, there is. You don't have a verse 15 in 3 John? Well, wait. Let me check something. Does the letter end in your Bible, peace be to you?
Peace to you, yes.
That's verse 15. Maybe it's not numbered, but okay, the text should be there. Okay, I was worried if the text wasn't there. It's not a big deal. Because we want to remember... The verse divisions are not inspired. That's a man-made invention, and it's very convenient. But the text is inspired, so I want to make sure that the text was in your Bible. Okay. Okay. Verses 13 to 15. So let's read them. I just did read them. Let's go back to notes. Page 90. John was now finished with what he had to say in this short letter, but he still had much to say to Gaius. He could have said more in writing, but as he had written in 2 John, he hoped to be able to soon communicate those things face to face. Same situation. This could have been written as a very long letter, but he said, I'm going to be seeing you soon. But that makes the things in this letter that much more important, doesn't it? Because these are the things that can't wait. Okay? John wished Gaius peace and passed on greetings from the friends at his congregation. Similarly, he wanted Gaius to greet the friends in Gaius's congregation by name. The use of the term friends twice in these closing statements is perhaps one final reminder to Gaius that believers in every place are or should be a network of friends who are ready to help one another should the need arise. It is part of the beauty of true faith in God that one can meet people whom he has never met before in places far from home and discover through a shared faith an immediate bond of friendship. And let me end with an interesting illustration. When I go on tour, like in October I'm going to North Carolina. I've never been there before. I'm going to churches I've never been to before. I'll be meeting people I've never met before. Everyone will be a stranger. I've been doing this for 11 years. And what I have found is it always goes the same. I'm nervous.
how are they going to respond to me? Am I going to get along with them? Their culture is different than mine. Of course, we're a multicultural country, aren't we? We're a melting pot. I'm from the Northeast. I'm a Jewish person from the Northeast. I'm going to be ministering to Gentiles from North Carolina. How will the church receive me? So forth and so on. And what I have found always is that I'll get there, and let's just assume for the moment my first stop, I'm staying at a hotel. Sometimes I stay at hotels, usually I stay in someone's houses, but every once in a while the church just finds it more convenient to get me a hotel room, or says maybe it's more convenient for you, which in some ways it is, but it's also nice to stay at someone's house because then you get the blessings you were talking about. But let's just assume it's a hotel, and you'll see why. So now I always get there Saturday. That's my travel day, because Sunday morning is my first speaking engagement. So I wake up, I put my suit on, and I got my notes, and I got everything, and I'm nervous. How are they going to receive me? Am I going to get along with them? What are they going to think about me? Blah, 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 blah. I walk into the church, and immediately all of the anxiety goes away, because I can immediately feel the love of my family as I meet the people. The way I'm greeted, the way people respond to me, the way we easily engage in conversation and find we have, although we're from different cultures and have never met and so forth and so on, we have such important and significant things in common, and we both have the same spirit. And that always happens to me. Even when I'm doing a local meeting, when I have to travel somewhere, maybe up to L.A., to speak at a church that I've never been to, I'm always a little nervous and apprehensive at first. I walk in and I start to meet the people and I relax. It's because we're all friends, but we're friends in a different way than the world considers friendship. We're family. And that is such a blessing to me. It's such a blessing to me to travel around the country and see these people from different cultures and backgrounds, but we enjoy one another. And that's not human, really. Usually different cultures separate. That's why in the big cities there's cultural pockets, aren't there? I know in Philadelphia there's the Italian area, and then there's an area that used to be Jewish. It's been changing, but there's the Jewish area. There's an area where the Asians live. There's cultural little pockets. We separate from one another. But I find I've gone into churches. I've gone into Asian churches. I've gone into churches in the southern, in the Bible Belt. I've gone into Spanish-speaking churches, people from Mexico. I've gone into black Afro-American churches. We're all believers. We're all children of God. And so there's been none of that worldly, earthly, you know, stuff. And it blesses it that much more. I find if I go into a Jewish congregation to minister, then we're all of the same culture and everything is, you know, not one nice and wonderful, and it's a wonderful time. But to tell you the truth, when I go to a church that I've never been to minister, and let's assume, I don't know, let's say it's an Afro-American, a black church, and I go in and I'm loved by those people, and I find myself just naturally having a love for them, there's an added blessing. Because I know this is not from the world. This is not the way the world operates. This is from God. We're all children of God. And it doesn't make any difference to God whether you're white or black or male or female or Asian or Mexican or Puerto Rican or Russian. None of that matters. What matters is that we know the Savior, we obey His commandments, and we love one another. And the reason we're able to do that is because of what He's done for us. The reason we're able to live completely contrary to the way the world lives is because of what He's done for us. And that's why what John, you know, you might have a tendency to say, well, 3 John isn't as important as 1 and 2, because 1 and 2 is where the doctrine is. But you can see how important 3 John is. If you're not, let's put it this way. If you're not living the way John expresses one should live in 3 John, then what good are 1 and 2 John doing you anyway? It's just a bunch of intellectual facts. 1 and 2 John, if you really believe 1 and 2 John, and you really do believe it, you will not be a Diotrephes, you will be a Demetrius and a Gaius. See what I'm saying? So this is a very important, this short 14 or 15 verse letter, God was careful to preserve it miraculously. It's inspired, it's in the scriptures, and it's of great importance. It's not, you know, a lot of people look at that short little letter at the end of the Bible. You know, it's extremely important because it really encapsulates, it's really the climax of all that John has to teach. He teaches, as we've seen, some pretty heavy doctrine in 1 and 2 John, and consider the Gospel of John. And then right at the top of the hill is this is what it looks like. This is what it looks like in 3 John. So we don't want to downplay 3 John just because it's short and it's not full of all kinds of interesting controversial doctrines. It's an extremely important part of the Scriptures. Any final thoughts, comments, questions? Okay, let me...